From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Ken Burns. His upcoming PBS documentary series tells the story of World War II through the eyes of the soldiers who fought and the people who waited for them back home. We'll talk with Burns about what he wanted to do differently from other World War II documentaries and how far he's willing to challenge FCC rulings on the language used in the film. Also, critic at large John Powers has been wondering what he takes for granted after watching the film Amazing Grace. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new recording by the band LCD Sound System. Their previous album was nominated for a Grammy for Best Electronic Dance Album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The next Ken Burns documentary for PBS, called The War, is a 15-hour examination of World War II from the perspective of the soldiers who fought and their loved ones back home. It doesn't premiere until September 23rd, 6 months from now. But because of the controversy surrounding the series and the opportunity to have seen it early, we're talking to Ken Burns about it now. One reason we're excited about The War is simply because of how good it is. In my opinion, it's not only the best thing Ken Burns has done since the Civil War, it's the best thing he's done ever. Burns made his first documentary film, Brooklyn Bridge, in 1981. There were only a few segments in it featuring what we now think of as the familiar Ken Burns technique, using music, sound effects, and slow, deliberate panning and zooming to bring still images to life. And those were built mainly around drawings, not photographs. But the style and the way Burns told the story was singularly impressive from the beginning. Six documentaries and 9 years later, he made the epic that turned him into a household name, The Civil War, the 1990 PBS series that remains his most acclaimed work. Since then, Burns has made a dozen other documentaries, large and small. The smaller-scale ones include excellent programs about Mark Twain, Thomas Jefferson, and Jack Johnson. The behemoths include baseball and jazz, both of which generated as much discussion in some circles for what they left out as what they included. There already are controversies surrounding the war, and we'll get to them in a minute. But first, let's hear a sample from the first episode of the series. It features veteran Glenn Frazier, who fought in the Pacific.
One day, Glenn Frazier volunteered for burial detail.
On some days, we buried 250 men. So I didn't know but what one day might happen to me. So my idea was, I had two sets of dog tags, and I said to myself, well, I think I'll just throw one of these sets of dog tags in the mass grave. So if I'm alive when the war ends, that's no problem. But if I'm missing or dead, I wanted my family to know and have some kind of ending and so forth, so they would think that I was in this grave.
The War is told from the perspective of soldiers from four distinct American cities or towns. I talked to Ken Burns earlier this week and asked him why he decided to organize the story that way.
Well, though World War II is done to death, it was our sense that it's often mediated and interrupted by the top-down view, the being inside Roosevelt's and Churchill's minds, the celebrity generals' strategies, tactics, weaponry, all things Nazi. And it's not what actually happened in this worst of all possible wars, not the good war. So we thought we'd take a handful of towns and get to know their warp and their woof, what the movie palaces were that they were going to watch the news from afar, get to know the streets that people lived on, and then just send them off to hell and their sons off to hell and do the war through their eyes. And paradoxically, we were able, I think, to also have a kind of an overview of the war that came out of this intensely bottom-up. These are all ordinary people. They're not experts. They're not historians. They're regular folks that you might have had Thanksgiving with. And that was our idea, to see the war in an experiential way through their eyes. And so we went to each of these towns and went into the archives, went to the newspapers, told them what we were doing, and just sort of began to take in, to drink in who we found and the stories set against the backdrop of this greatest of all human cataclysms, the Second World War.
Well, Ken, how did you and Lynn Novick, who, you know, directs and produces this with you, decide upon which four towns? Was it geographical, or was it because you found people in them that were sort of like Forrest Gump and were everywhere?
Well, you know, there was a couple of places where it was that backward thread, David, you know, where we're undoing the sweater that way because people had been somewhere. But mostly it was, you know, we wanted a northeast town and didn't want to do the more familiar places of Brooklyn or Boston or whatever. And Waterbury was a perfect place. It was called Brass City. Even in the 19th century, they made everything and turned all of their efforts into the war effort once Pearl Harbor had taken place. We'd read a memoir by a man named Eugene Sledge about his experiences in the South Pacific on Peleliu and Okinawa. We thought it was one of the best that had ever been done. And he lived in Mobile, and when we arrived there, he had just passed away. But his family introduced us to his best friend and his best friend's sister, and we then sort of expanded our circle in Mobile and then got an actor to read portions of this memoir. And we're looking for a West Coast town and picked Sacramento because it had it was the intersection of so many different things and had a Japanese-American community. And we felt the irony of fighting freedom abroad while it was still curtailed for Japanese-Americans and African-Americans was an important story to tell. And then we knew we wanted a small town. Waterbury, Mobile, and Sacramento are all about 100,000 population at the time of Pearl Harbor. And we wanted also that kind of the feel of a small town. And we picked Luverne, Minnesota, because we had come in contact with a fighter pilot whose first day of work was June 6, 1944, D-Day. And then for the next 10 months just saw almost unspeakable things from the air and losing friends and dealing out death and nearly escaping death a lot of times.
Unlike a lot of your previous massive documentaries, you are very shy on other historians here.
There are none. In fact, there are a couple of people who have written about the war in our film, but we're not interested in their overview of the war or their getting us from point A to point B or helping us understand this important piece of strategy. We're interested in what they felt like when they were 18 or 19 or 20 years old and facing death almost daily in the case of one of these two gentlemen. And so they sort of take their place back in line with the rest of the so-called ordinary people. We did not want this mediated by the people who have the armchair ability to talk about it, but were never in it. So if you weren't in this war or you weren't anxiously waiting for a loved one to come home, you're not in our film.
I'm having you early because your new big documentary series, The War, doesn't begin until September 23rd on PBS, but it's already got a couple of controversies attached to it. And you'd think that The War, which is about World War II, would be kind of safe. But here we go again. And I guess if we want to summarize them, one is that the experience of Latino soldiers in World War II, some 500,000 soldiers, is said to be not properly represented in the 15 hours. And I thought that we would just start by talking about how that accusation or allegation fits into how you designed the series and which stories you decided to tell in telling the story of the war.
Yeah, well, I think the way we constructed it sort of renders a little bit of the protest mood. I mean, I can understand, particularly in the Hispanic community, after 500 years of having so much of their history marginalized and this continent, how important it is to be told. But we knew going in we weren't going to be able to tell the whole story. And in fact, we limited the film to four geographically distributed towns and a handful of people from those towns. And we're actually not, with the exception of Japanese Americans and to a much lesser extent, African Americans, who had an amazingly different kind of American experience, i.e. they were interned and in segregated regiments, looking for any type of people in the film. We were looking for universal human experience of battle, of what was it like to be in that war and not try to cover every group. We left out lots of people in many, many different kinds of groups because we weren't looking at it in that way.
All right. The other controversy that comes up with the war that's already here, and I, as a TV critic, am sort of stunned by this one, but it's the Federal Communications Commission, and ever since Janet Jackson had her wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl a few years ago, there has been a real timidity about what can be shown or can't be shown or will be fined or won't be fined by the various networks, and the rules keep changing, and you can't get rulings in advance because the FCC says that would be prior censorship. And so context is everything, but context isn't necessarily protection. So what you are looking for or looking to face in the war is in 15 hours. I think there are three words in it that might be considered obscene words. You know,
there are three words that are objectionable, and one is spoken by one of our on-camera folks who were describing what it was like to be shot at as a ball turret gunner in the belly of a B-17 airplane over Germany and France in the early years of the air war, and blurts out in a kind of almost stream of consciousness how he felt when some of the German fighter planes, which were of course much faster and swifter and could stand off and lob rockets at great distance, what it felt like to be shot at. And it's a blurred out. And the other one is actually spoken by our narrator trying to contain the sense of frustration, and I think what everybody feels when dealing with a massive bureaucracy like this man's army. And in a particularly negative point in the war, when we thought it was over and it turned out it wasn't over, and it, in fact, a lot more killing was going to take place than had taken place before. You know, the controversy is a little bit of, it's hard to read what it's really about. I obviously, the paradigms are shifting in our country. We've had Saving Private Ryan, which is an excellent film, but a work of fiction, so that its use of the F word, for example, is done, one could say, gratuitously dozens of times in that film, and it had an exemption and was shown on broadcast news.
Broadcast television more than once.
More than once. My feeling is about this is that we will give ample warning. We will let, obviously, those stations that are most anxious about it do what they have to do.
And the potential fines per station is like $325,000?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what they are. There's a current case that is in adjudication right now that had to do with Martin Scorsese's The Blues series, mm-hmm. in which one station in California was, there were complaints from that local area. We still don't know the outcome of that case. But I think it's made everybody, not just in public television, but across the spectrum, pretty anxious and nervous.
Well, let's listen to one of the actual controversial uses of words within the war and put it into context. It is, as we said, from the ground up kind of perspective. So this is the frustration of soldiers in the war about things that aren't being done right by their commanders, or equipment that isn't gotten there on time, or some of the things that happens in every war. And it's actually not even so isolated, because it is the name of the actual fifth episode, which is FUBAR. So let's play that.
The men coined names for the chaos in which they often found themselves, and the ineptitude of some of the officers who sent them there, employing language they would never have used in front of their mothers or their wives back home. Snafu, situation normal, all up. And FUBAR, up beyond all recognition.
A scene from the upcoming documentary series, The War. More with filmmaker Ken Burns after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Ken Burns. We're talking about his upcoming documentary series, The War, about World War II. It premieres on PBS this fall. Of all the voices in the war, I was familiar with Ernie Pyle. I was familiar with some of the other people, but not Al McIntosh. I have never heard of this newspaper guy before. He wrote for the Rock County Star-Herald. How did you find this guy and his work, and how excited were you when you found it?
I think that in some ways Al McIntosh might be the single greatest archival discovery that we have ever made. We went to the microfilm and discovered that this man who had the opportunity to work at other big city newspapers and turn them down, Al McIntosh, a native of North Dakota, found himself in southwestern Minnesota in this tiny town, 3,000 folks, writing for the Rock County Star, the Rock County Star Herald, just on a front page column, just got it. And he passed away, I'm happy to say, of old age in the 70s. And we were able to get Tom Hanks to read it. And it was very interesting because we collected, I'd say, 15 or 20 quotes, which meant that it would just be incredible if we used 10 of them in the final film. And Tom came in and read them just beautifully. I mean, we were just stunned at how he got them. And he then wrote a letter to me about a month later saying, "I'm dreaming of Al McIntosh. Is there any more?" And that sent us back to the archives. And we excavated even more of the column. And essentially through Tom's urging, went and found more and brought it back. And now, as you know, having seen it, Al McIntosh is in every episode. He is the one-man Greek chorus that not only helps explain the unexplainable to the folks of Luverne, Minnesota, he explains it to us. And his concerns, I mean, he stands on a street corner in the center of town and he watches Scotty Dewars, the depot agent, walk across the street to deliver a telegram to the Lester family. And the father says, "Which one?" He's got two sons overseas. And so he's aware of the tiny minutiae of the geography of loss.
Well, let's play a taste of one of Al McIntosh's columns for the Rock County Star-Herald. You'll hear Tom Hanks's work. This is right after D-Day, right at D-Day. So let's play that.
This is Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, all night long, bulletins have been pouring in from Berlin claiming that D-Day is here, claiming that the invasion of Western Europe has begun.
When we stumbled sleepily down the hall to answer the ringing telephone, we made a mental note that it was shortly before 3 a.m. We picked up the receiver thinking it was Sheriff Roberts calling to say there had been an accident. Instead, it was Mrs. Lloyd Long, playing the feminine counterpart of Paul Revere, saying, "Get up, Al, and listen to the radio. The invasion has started."
Says the British-American landing operations from the sea and from the air are stretching over.
We sat by the radio for over an hour, listening to the breathtaking announcements.
Casualties may reach a dreadful toll.
And then we went to bed, to lie there for a long time, wide-eyed in the darkness, thinking, what Rock County boys are landing on French soil tonight? Al McIntosh, Rock County Star-Herald.
You've also done a documentary on Mark Twain, so I'm sure this doesn't escape you how clear and clean this guy's writing style is. It's amazing to think it's 50, 60 years old.
It is amazing, and it just goes right into your heart. And that's a particularly dramatic moment. We're looking at the exterior of his house, the house of Al McIntosh, with the lights turning on in the middle of the night. It's the fullest extent of recreation we have in our film. And you're looking at a radio and a dial and the interior of the house and an old phone there. And he just brings that immediacy. You've just been in this battle. You've just landed at Omaha Beach. And now it's time to find out how everybody else is going to do it. And throughout the film, he just has a turn of phrase or an expression. He might be talking about the clink of the horseshoes down by the highway next to the baseball lot on the quiet 4th of July of 1944 as they're worrying not just about breaking out of the hedgerows in Normandy, but about what's going on in Saipan and the whispers they're getting from there. He sort of holds your hand, and it's not damp and clammy. It's warm, and you just sort of feel, you know, you can get through it. But he's having a hard time, too, and the writing is just gorgeous.
There's an outreach effort connected with this where anybody listening who has a relative who served in World War II is being encouraged, I suppose, to get their stories recorded while they're still alive. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think we're taking a page out of Steven Spielberg's remarkable effort in his Shoah project, that is documenting the testimony of survivors of the Holocaust. We have 1,000 veterans a day dying in the United States, and we're interested in finding out what life was like for them and indeed what was like for the person who stayed home, the spouse who stayed home. And we have a bunch of kids who've now, the basic information about the Second World War has begun to atrophy. A lot of kids think we fought with the Germans against the Russians in the Second World War when the opposite is the truth. But nearly all of them have a DV camera or have access to them. And we thought, wouldn't it be good that they could stop, download some simple instructions from us on how to shoot and how to light, maybe some sample questions, and go and, for their family's benefit, record this history and find out what grandma and grandpa did, or great-grandpa or great-grandma, whoever it is. And then if they're so disposed, to make a copy and send it to the Library of Congress, and all of this will be up and running by the late spring, and allows us a fuller picture of what happened.
Documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. More on his new series, The War, in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire. While the breeze on high sang a lullaby, you'd be all that I could desire. Under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above, you'd be so nice, you'd be paradise.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the visual thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From the Joyce Foundation, supporting efforts to educate America's workforce and improve the quality of teaching in low-achieving schools, joycefdn.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, connecting social entrepreneurs around the world with an online community called Social Edge. Learn more at socialedge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Powers considers the film Amazing Grace about the British anti-slave crusader William Wilberforce. Ken Tucker reviews Sound of Silver, the new recording by the electronic band LCD Sound System. And we continue our conversation with Ken Burns. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Ken Burns has made some of the most famous and well-received documentaries in television history: the Civil War, baseball, jazz. This September, he adds to that list with the PBS series The War, an outstanding 15-hour examination of World War II. It finds a new way to tell a story that in recent years has become more and more familiar. Let me play a clip now from The War, which I guess is your most direct comparison with what we know of as the Hollywood version with Spielberg and Saving Private Ryan. It opened his film. It's in the middle of your documentary. It's Omaha Beach and the start of D-Day. And so this is the beginning of how it is done by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick and everybody else involved in the war. We'll listen to it first, and then we'll talk about the elements within it.
Far offshore, General Bradley considered abandoning Omaha rather than sending in more men to die. Then, the Americans began to improvise. Commanders defied orders and risked tearing the bottom from their ships to bring them within 1,000 yards of the beach and use their guns to finally knock out the German pillboxes and gun emplacements. And on the beach itself, officers and enlisted men alike began taking their survival into their own hands. "They're murdering us here," one wounded officer shouted to his men. "Let's move inland and get murdered there instead." Here and there, individuals got to their feet and started forward. Then small groups began to follow.
Okay, we're robbed, of course, by listening on the radio to the pictures and the images. But talk about what's involved in putting that all together, all those layers of sound and pictures.
Well, what it is visually that you are missing is a set of still photographs taken by Robert Capa and others, some footage, newsreel footage, taken by the very, very brave cameramen who covered the war without the benefit of sidearms or rifles to protect themselves, and then a music track. In this case, you heard entering in halfway through that clip, Edgar Meyer piece. But mostly what it is for us is taking the basic DNA of what we do, which is a still photograph, and not just looking at it and going inside and living within it visually, but listening to it, as sort of odd as that may sound. We're interested in the old Civil War. Is that cannon firing? Are those bayonets, sabers rattling? You know, in the jazz film, is the ice on the bar clinking in the glass? In the baseball film, are the crowds roaring at the crack of a bat? We want to listen to these photographs. And in the case of this, it represents our most sophisticated attempt to bring to life, in some ways to will to life, to beg out of these still photographs and silent newsreel footage, a reality that we can't touch, but we can approximate. And so we researched for years and years what different guns sounded like. And what you listened to just now might represent at any given time 50 or 60 or 70 or 100 different layers of sound. If not engaged at that moment, then there for possible use. And so you could hear the spray of the sea against the metal LST. You can hear what those big guns in the Navy ship sound like. You can hear the ping of a machine gun in addition to the machine gun sound. You hear the distant sound of men falling, struggling in surf, and the splashes that that might do. You hear bullets hitting sand. It's not all of it. We're not asking you to hear and identify and separate all of that. We're asking you to suspend where you are and for a moment experience what it might have been like for these teenagers, most of them, who, I don't know what you were doing when you were 17 and 18 and 19 years old, a time when I think most of us had the luxury of inattention and narcissistic self-involvement. These guys were helping to save the world, and we felt honor-bound as sort of just as we were bearing witness to their testimony and the couple of men that we follow at that particular moment, that morning on June 6th. Couples with all the other stories, that we also had to sort of bear witness to what it was like to be in that war. And in a way, that's the one question, the overarching question was, what was it like?
My guest is documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the upcoming PBS documentary series, The War, with filmmaker Ken Burns. His other famous and well-received documentaries include Baseball, Jazz, and The Civil War, which premiered 17 years ago. Probably your most classic documentary moment up to this point ended the first episode of The Civil War, and it was the letter from Sullivan Ballou. And what made that leap out among all the thousands of documents as the killer moment that you knew was going to end that work?
You know, I'm pulling out my wallet, and I'm pulling out the
You're
pages.
Still carrying that?
I was sent in 1985 or 86 by one of our two dozen consultants on the Civil War, who were all just the cream of the crop, ranging from Marxist historians on the left to sort of historians of the lost cause on the right, if that's what it's called, and Robert Penn Warren and others. But one, Robert Johansson, sent me this letter that he'd come across in the Illinois State Library, I think it was. And I read it out loud and broke down in tears and realized that that was how the first episode was going to end. And we'd already begin playing with a piece of music that wasn't written in the Civil War called Ashokan Farewell, written by one of our session violinists. And they had been playing a lot of Civil War tunes, and we knew that it was going to be filled all with authentic Civil War music. But this one tune was so haunting and seemed to cross the gap between the present and the past. And I just knew, even though the First Battle of Bull Run, from which this letter was from, had taken place earlier in the episode, that this would be something that would be the cork in the bottle, that would just say, this is the emotional archaeology that we are seeking to excavate here.
Well, here is the poetry of Sullivan Ballou from the Civil War, ending the first episode, 1990, that's 17 years ago.
I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the Revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I have enjoyed with you come crowding over me. And I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I've enjoyed them for so long. And how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years, when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and see our boys grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you. Nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name.
We're talking with Ken Burns, documentary filmmaker. All right, now I'm going to ask you something a lot less serious, but something that sort of baffles me and amuses me at the same time, and I want to know how you feel about it. There's a function in an Apple program called the Ken Burns Effect. What do you think about? Do you know about this, and did you pay for it, and what do you think about it?
Well, it's a wonderful story. I was called up by Steve Jobs, a man whose work I admire and who I'm proud to say is become a friend of mine. And he invited me several years ago to California and ushered me into a room where he and a couple of other engineers were excitedly going to demonstrate something that they had spent some time mastering, which they had as a working title called the Ken Burns Effect, that permitted people who had their photographs on their iPhoto programs to move, pan and zoom through the photographs. And I just looked up and I said, this is wonderful. I don't do commercial endorsements. And their faces fell. And so we worked out a deal where they provide us some computer equipment, most of which I give to a nonprofit that my wife founded and runs. And we all feel very good about it. But the funny thing is I'm fairly much a computer Luddite. And so when I pass an Apple store anywhere in the world, people will see me and pour out to tell me the latest application that they used of it and some amazing thing. And they asked me these incredibly important questions. And I have to affect a kind of, you know, kind of wise inscrutability to just escape the abject embarrassment of these moments when they do it. What it is essentially an acknowledgement that for too long we've held still photographs at arm's length. And they represented, as I've said, the DNA of our visual historical experience.
But don't you feel a little sheepish? I mean, you're not the person to have invented zooms or pans.
Nope. No, definitely not. But I think, you know, the Civil War and earlier films, starting with the Brooklyn Bridge, was really taking them out for a spin. There are certainly other films, but I think we began treating those old photographs as reality and adding a sound effects track that permitted. So it's both funny, embarrassing, and, you know, it brought me a good friendship.
Okay. Now, were you always a history dweeb?
No, not at all. In fact, I was surprised to learn at a high school reunion or coming in contact with somebody who'd been in junior high with me, actually. He said that he remembered me in history class, world history class, in ninth grade, that he just looked at me and he said, that's what he's going to do. At that time, I wanted to be a writer and a filmmaker. I wanted to be Alfred Hitchcock. My dad had let me stay up late one night, and we'd seen Vertigo, and I just thought, that's it. I'm going to be John Ford or Alfred Hitchcock and do that. And so I ended up, you know, on this track to be a feature filmmaker and went to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, and all the teachers were social documentary still photographers, Jerome Liebling, Elaine Mays, and they reminded me quite correctly that there's much more drama in what is and what was than in anything the human imagination dreams of. And all of a sudden, I found myself interested in documentary and what I had, latent and essentially untrained. I've never taken a history course except Russian history in college. Was this just abiding love of and curiosity about what happened in my country's history. And boom, the last film I did in college was about Old Sturbridge Village, and the last shot of that, believe it or not, is a pan across a painting, not a photograph, but a painting. And it was just such a prescient thing because the next thing I've done for the next 32 years has been all in American history.
Well, good luck to you with the war and with the fight about the war in terms of the censorship. I like the war a lot, and I guess that's all your fault. So so thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you, David.
Filmmaker Ken Burns. His new documentary series about World War II, The War, premieres September 23rd on PBS. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade in Britain. The new movie, Amazing Grace, is about the British abolitionist movement and focuses on the man who led the fight in Parliament. Our critic at large, John Powers, has seen the film and says the story made him think about his own life.
Hollywood loves making historical movies, but it finds the history part tricky. Life, sad to say, just doesn't have the dramatic shape of a good commercial screenplay. And so the movies streamline things, often by fitting grand events into the stories of heroic individuals, like Abe Lincoln, Gandhi, or Steve Biko. That's what happens in Amazing Grace, Michael Apted's devoutly old-fashioned biopic of the 18th-century politician William Wilberforce. Wilberforce was an evangelical Christian who, torn between serving God and serving his fellow man, split the difference. He joined up with the movement to abolish slavery and the slave trade in Britain, thereby honoring the God-given rights and dignity of all men. His passionate eloquence got him dubbed the Nightingale of the House of Commons, and it made him the official leading voice of the abolitionist movement. Here, Wilberforce, played by TV's Horatio Hornblower, Ewan Griffith, gets a bunch of MPs aboard a slave ship and then gives them a lesson.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a slave ship, the Madagascar. It has just returned from the Indies, where it delivered 200 men, women, and children to Jamaica. When it left Africa, there were 600 on board. The rest died of disease or despair. That smell is the smell of death. Slow, painful death. Breathe it in. Breathe it deeply. Take those handkerchiefs away from your noses. There now. Remember that smell. Remember the Madagascar. Remember that God made men equal.
As you can tell from this clip's lack of nuance, Amazing Grace is giving us a lesson too, a history lesson, one slightly skewed by focusing on Wilberforce, who was, after all, only one actor in a grand moral crusade. Not that the movie denies the existence of his allies. We meet the heroic ex-slave Eladio Equiano and the repentant slave ship captain John Newton, who wrote the great hymn Amazing Grace. Still, watching this film, you might think that Wilberforce was the movement's towering figure, when that honor surely went to Thomas Clarkson, here played by Rufus Sewell, wearing a thatched roof of unfortunate hair. Yet for all its simplifications and bouts of corniness, I'm pleased to see Amazing Grace in our theaters. This is not because we still need to be told that slavery is wrong, those frat boys in Borat notwithstanding, but because its story has enduring importance. First of all, because it marks a breakthrough. Although it now seems natural that there would be social movements championing the rights of women, gays and lesbians, or immigrant workers, such movements are actually a historical late bloomer. In his superb book on the abolitionists, Bury the Chains, Adam Hochschild notes that the anti-slavery movement was, and I'm quoting him here, the first time a large number of people became outraged, and stayed outraged for many years, over someone else's rights. In their organized empathy, the abolitionists' newsletters, public meetings, parliamentary maneuvers, and boycotts of slave-grown sugar set a template for what would follow. And it showed that such a movement could prevail, even when faced with seemingly insurmountable obstacles like millennial prejudice, warnings of economic collapse, and the enormous power of those profiting directly from the slave trade. Incidentally, these are the same obstacles faced today by the likes of Sam Brownback, the evangelical Kansas senator who's been called a Wilberforce Republican, who's waging an admirable crusade against the sexual enslavement of women. George Orwell famously wrote that to see what's in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle. Amazing Grace makes this abundantly clear. We grasp that the pro-slavery forces couldn't or wouldn't see their victims' humanity. For most white Europeans at the time, the slave's inferiority was inscribed in nature and didn't bear any looking into. As I watched Amazing Grace, I found myself thinking not about their historical blindness, but about my own. Now, I like to think I'm a decent fellow. I'm all for equal rights, fair wages, and green initiatives. I give money to human rights organizations and tsunami victims. But in the big picture, this is the easy stuff. I keep wondering what I take for granted that will shock posterity, the way the belief in slavery now shocks us. Could it be the idea that it's okay to raise animals purely for the purpose of slaughtering and eating them? Could it be the idea that human beings are divided up into nations, so that being born on different sides of an artificially created border, like that between the U.S. and Mexico, means having vastly different rights and possibilities? Or could it be something so deeply embedded in my own way of seeing, I can't even bring it up here? I wish I had the amazing grace to know.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me, that saved a wretch like me.
Coming up, Ken Tucker on the new CD from LCD Sound System. This is Fresh Air. LCD Sound System is a band that exists primarily in the recording studio, with singer-writer-producer James Murphy playing most of the instruments. When LCD Sound System performs live, he usually assembles a four-piece band that can reproduce the kind of dance-punk electronica mixture that won the band's previous album a Grammy nomination in 2005. Rock critic Ken Tucker says LCD Sound System's new album, called Sound of Silver, broadens the project's sound to make Murphy's rhythms even more accessible.
Read all the pamphlets
and watch the tapes.
Read all the pamphlets
and watch the tapes.
Read all the pamphlets
and watch the tapes.
I get all confused with you. Mix up the dates.
James Murphy once said that he conceives LCD Sound System as, quote, a laboratory for experiments on what a band should be, which is probably one reason he makes most of the music himself in a studio. What other supporting musicians would want to be treated like lab rats? Murphy's concept of songcraft is to write long compositions that gradually build in intensity, adding instruments and voices as the song goes on. When combined with his hip-shaking, head-bobbing rhythms, the result is a swirling, hypnotic sound. On that song called Us Versus Them, or Us V Them as Murphy sings it, Murphy chants a chorus that goes, the time has come today. Combine that with the old-fashioned instrument that Murphy loves to use to augment his electronica, the cowbell, and you get a strong echo of the 1968 Chambers Brothers hit, Time Has Come Today. It's a reference few of Murphy's too cool for school audience is likely to pick up on. Most reviews of LCD Sound System mention the cool jerk sounds of Brian Eno and David Byrne's Talking Heads. But I like the way Murphy's musical knowledge is all over the map, from 60s soul to the contemporary French duo Daft Punk.
Oh, I don't know, I don't know, oh, where to begin. We are North Americans, and for those of you who still think we're from England, we're not, no. We bit our planes and our trains till we think we might die. Far from North America, where the buildings are old and you might have lots of mimes. I hate the feeling when you're looking at me that way. Cause we're North Americans, but if we act all shy, it'll make it okay. It makes it go away. All over again. Come on, North America.
That's the first single off Sound of Silver, North American Scum. The song, I'm glad to report, isn't some trendy, self-flagellating tirade. It starts off self-deprecatingly, with Murphy telling his listeners that LCD Sound System isn't from England, as apparently many of his initial fans thought, given the fact that his first 2002 breakthrough single, Losing My Edge, was a top 20 pop hit over there. It was an underground club hit in Murphy's native America. He's from New Jersey, to be exact. Lyrics are clearly secondary to Murphy's way of working. He likes to transform pseudo-profound observations into chants that he intones over and over again until they become almost meaningless, and you're forced to simply appreciate the music behind them, as on the title track.
Sound of Silver, talk to me. Makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me. Makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember. think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me. Makes you wanna feel like a teenager. Until you remember the feelings of a real life emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of Silver.
Pretty much the entire lyric of that song is, Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager, until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager, then you think again. It's kind of funny, kind of poignant, but placed in the context of the burbling electronic keyboard and drums background pulse, mostly just silly ironic. There's not much depth or resonance to the music Murphy makes with LCD Sound System. But sometimes, as in the case of this capacious, inviting album, surface pleasures are so satisfying, they take on their own deeper meanings.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Sound of Silver by LCD Sound System. If you want to catch up on Fresh Airs that you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
St. Patrick was a gentleman, his name we celebrate.
And on the next Fresh Air, the story behind a forgotten Irish-American songwriting team, Harrigan and Bran. They wrote songs about New York for the stage in the late 1800s, before Tin Pan Alley. We talk with Mick Maloney and hear music from his CD of their songs. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And it's two by two, away we go, up Broadway through.